Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Macro Monthly Podcast Series here on the UBS Market Moves Podcast Channel with colleagues from UBS Asset Management. Each month, we look forward to hearing from top investment professionals from the UBS Asset Management Multi-Asset Team. Joining us for this month's update, glad to welcome back Evan Brown, Portfolio Manager and Head of Multi-Asset Strategy. We're also joined today by Multi-Asset Specialist Fatu Conte. So with that, Evan and Fatu, thank you for dropping by and for spending some time today with our listeners. Fatu, let me now pass it over to you to lead today's conversation with Evan. Welcome back.
So for today's podcast, we'll touch on a couple themes, including, you know, the state of the global economy, markets, and then we'll close out with how we're positioned in the MAPS portfolios. So Evan, we're currently in the midst of a government shutdown, and that's meant that we haven't received some key economic data. In absence of this data, how are you tracking the U.S. economy?
Yeah, thanks, Fatu. And yes, as a macro guy, it is very disappointing not to be getting the official data coming from the government. But I would say the good news is we're getting enough from other sources such that we have a decent idea of where things are tracking. So, you know, we're most focused on the growth side, on the labor market, of course, and we had ADP come out today and showed that their private company that tracks job growth, and it showed a solid rebound there, which is good to see. We also get, even though we don't get the overall initial jobless claims, we get the state level jobless claims, and those are showing, you know, contained amount of layoffs. I'm also getting data from regional feds, and we listen a lot to what corporates are saying. We just had earnings season. We pay a lot of attention to what they're saying about the macro environment, particularly the banks, and still seeing good spending there. So overall, you know, across all of these private or other sources, we're still getting enough to suggest that the economy is showing some resilience. The labor market is soft, but it's not, you know, unraveling. The consumer is still spending, and we did get inflation data a couple of weeks ago, which came out not as bad as feared, because rents are coming down. That's offsetting the tariff. So I think we have a reasonably good picture showing an economy that's hanging in.
Great. And last week, the Fed cut rates by another 25 bips. And what was interesting is that further out the yield curve, rates actually rose. So why was this the case? And what are your expectations for the Fed moving forward?
Yeah, so it's what we call a hawkish cut. You know, the Fed did cut rates, but the messaging around it that we got from Chair Powell in his press conference was, you know, a little bit more hawkish, or perhaps less dovish is the way I would put it. He showed that a December cut is not a done deal, and the market had been pricing it as such. And essentially, the chair was saying that we have a broad committee with a wide range of views. And since the Fed meeting, we've had a number of members come out and say, you know, they're not so sure about further easing because inflation is still above target. And, you know, our view on this is that while there is some hesitation on the committee to be easing more, the Fed in general is still viewing itself rates right now in restrictive territory. And I think they're unlikely to get enough data giving them kind of the all clear on the labor market such that they'll feel comfortable skipping a meeting in December. So we do think that it's likely that the Fed cuts again in December and likely one more time at the start of next year. So we've seen, yeah, rates rise a bit, but it's not something that we're overly concerned about.
Great. And, you know, in line with the resilient macro backdrop that in the U.S. that you just described, in the November Macro Monthly, you know, you wrote a piece called The Key to This Cycle's Resilience. So what is actually behind this economic resilience, and what's going to keep this trend going?
So we wrote that piece, the key to private sector or key to cycles resilience, and the answer is what that key is then just how robust private sector balance sheets are. So have to remember that households, you know, since the Great Financial Crisis, delevered a ton over the ensuing years, such that overall household leverage is quite low. Same thing for the corporate sector, and same thing really for the banking sector. And that's been what has enabled us, even as we've had various shocks over the course of this cycle, whether it was the Fed having to hike rates 525 basis points in a short period, or Liberation Day, and then the fact that we're getting tariff levels that are getting pretty close to what Liberation Day announcement was. All in, the consumer and businesses have been able to hang in there, and that's because no one's out over their skis, or I shouldn't say no one. I mean, there's certainly pockets of excess, but on a big macro level, there's no significant need to retrench, whether it's consumer spending or on the CapEx side. And so that's something that we think is underappreciated this cycle. I mean, there's clearly a lot of focus on public debt. That's the flip side of this. You know, government debt is very high, and we address that in the piece as well. But in terms of like what matters most right now, it's really that strength of private sector balance sheets that we think has been core to the economy's resilience over the course of this cycle.
Kind of turning to markets here, I mean, AI this year has really driven returns, and because of that, there's been, you know, increasing talk emerging about a potential AI bubble. How are you thinking about this risk?
Yeah, so I think it's something to take seriously. It's hard to have a binary call of, oh, we're in a bubble, we're not in a bubble. If you compare it to the .com, if we're in a bubble, we're not nearly as inflated as we were back then, where you had companies where valuations were just completely detached from reality. The valuations of the big companies, the big tech companies that, are linked to AI, their valuations are rich, but they're not crazy. And the reason they're not crazy is because these companies still have incredible earnings growth. And that's something that you didn't see in .com. We're not overly concerned about this like big detachment from reality for the big companies, even though, you know, there are some retail favorites that look a little bit detached from reality, but that's not a major concern, you know, in a broad market sense. I think something though that we need to keep in mind is just the scale of investment in data centers that's being done, and there are questions to be raised about what will be the ultimate return on all this investment, return on the CapEx boom. And the reality is no one really knows. No one knows just how much AI is going to just how transformational it's going to be in terms of productivity and the like. And so I think what this speaks to is being diversified. I mean, if you just own passive, right? If you just own the S&P 500, now the top 10 companies make up more than 40% of the index. So really, passive is an active bet, right? You're making that a big active bet on those companies. And I think, you know, that speaks to being more diversified within the market, having active stock picking that is not necessarily, you know, all in on these companies where the return on investment is kind of unknown at this point. And just not having all your eggs in one basket.
Great. And I think another interesting theme this year has been kind of the emerging of some interesting catalysts globally. And back in October, you had published a macro monthly titled Asia, Reform, Innovation, and Room to Run. And that, I think that was a really timely piece given, you know, how dynamic that month turned out to be across the region. And we saw markets in Japan and Korea rally impressively. So with that momentum in mind, do you still see room for further upside in Asian equities?
Yeah, I mean, the timing of that piece was a little lucky. I certainly didn't know that Korea's KOSPI index was going to surge 25% in a month and Japan's Nikkei up 15%. I mean, a lot of things were falling into place at the same time. They're both levered to the tech cycle and semiconductors, and we've seen really a boom there and just really strong earnings growth. Also, both, you know, locking in trade deals and in Japan, we have a new prime minister, Takaichi, who looks to be pretty growth friendly. That's her coalition that she's built is likely to move reforms forward, which is good news on Japan. So all that's helping. But this is not just a short-term story. I think these are long-term stories in that Japan and Korea, there's in both countries a big regulatory push towards moving the corporate sector, you know, in a more shareholder-friendly direction. There's really positive corporate reform in both Japan and Korea, and that's what we highlighted in the piece, and that's why, despite, you know, some really significant gains, we actually still see room to run here for those companies.
Evan, thank you for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.